Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control.
Welcome all to Jughead's Basement. I am live from my 7-month living room in Cheviot, Ohio, where we just had to call the police on the neighbors for domestic violence. Our cat is fighting my printer, and my girlfriend is playing Xbox's Dishonored in the next room. And my radio crew of one, Jeremy, is located in Auburn, Illinois. Tonight, we will be exploring the 1991 release of Screeching Weasel's My Brain Hurts, which is a reference to the Monty Python sketch called Gumby Brain Specialist. If you are listening to this show live, please, if you have a story to tell relating to this record, or if you have a question about my own relationship with being in Screeching Weasel, please request my friendship through Facebook and instant message me your statement or questions. And hopefully sometime tonight, I can answer it with the most honesty I can gather. If you are listening to this on podcast or streaming, you can catch us every third Friday of the month, or thereabouts, and participate live by asking questions or sharing stories. This program will always be dictated by the order of the songs as they appear on the record featured each night. My good friends have spent much time contemplating the effect of My Brain Hurts on their lives, and they have all chosen specific songs that spoke directly to them. We will hear their pre-recorded voices in the exact order they appear on the record. Lawrence Livermore, the founder of Lookout Records, argued that we should not put this next song as the lead-off song on the record, but Ben and I were adamant that we wanted the most explosive song on the record first, not necessarily the best. I feel this decision was correct. Here is Kevin Prested, a Melbourne, Australia-based lifelong music archivist and author of the as-yet-published book on the history of Lookout Records and its bands entitled Punk USA, with his thoughts on Making You Cry.
Making You Cry, track one from the 1991 Screeching Weasel album My Brain Hurts, certainly holds a relevance to myself in what will become a lifelong passion with not only 90s punk, but also the home of the release, Lookout Records. Although I'd certainly been aware of the band's previous records, mainly singles, Making You Cry would be my first real Screeching Weasel album track I would hear while sitting down to give My Brain Hurts its first listen 20 years ago. Having been already absorbing the works of American hardcore pioneers such as Minor Threat and Youth of Today, along with the then-current straight edge and hardcore bands prior, 1992 would mark one of my major introductions to the poppier end of the underground, via labels such as Doctor Strange, Cruise, and most importantly Lookout Records. I had already previously found a chord had been struck while discovering bands such as Agent Orange, The Descendants and The Chemical People, bands mixing the punk urgency with the obvious melodic edge. I found a whole new world in Lookout, still reasonably in its infancy at that point. After finding some of the label's earliest singles at record fairs, My Brain Hurts would be my first full-length purchase, not only by Lookout Records, but also Screeching Weasel. As the album opener, Making You Cry, was absorbed, I was immediately struck with the upbeat energy that certainly at the time captured a musical scene that was set to explode. In my mind, I also set this album, the band's third, as a standalone release in sound and atmosphere. Although definitely different from another of my favourite Screeching Weasel albums, Anthem for a New Tomorrow, My Brain Hurts still moves me after 20 years in the same way. What My Brain Hurts did for me 20 years ago certainly helped pave the way for helping me to delve further into the underground at the time, a scene that was percolating. I often hear, and it's common knowledge, that the band have been lumbered with a three-chord Ramones tag over the years, yet I still will argue the point that Screeching Weasel remained diverse, at least in its earlier years. For this reason, My Brain Hurts is the standalone album in a canon of individual-sounding records in its first run. In hindsight, 20 years later, we were hearing for the first time so many important albums from the underground in the early 1990s. Records that defined the changing musical landscape and were beginning to bring to the forefront the stylings that would penetrate the mainstream only a few years later. My Brain Hurts wholeheartedly captured a passionate and energetic sound for the followers of the punk scene that was set to influence thousands of others as it became not only one of the Screeching Weasel milestones, but also one of my own.
Early in Screeching Weasel's career, we went head-to-head, well, more like head-to-mic, against the Chicago Skinheads, eventually leading to them putting out a quote-unquote death warrant on Ben Weasel. This attitude in their way of thinking is partially depicted in this song called Slogans. Recently I was told that the band John Cougar Concentration Camp covered My Brain Hurts in its entirety, so I interviewed Chris Fields from the band about why they would do such a thing. I also must add that Weasel is not estranged from such a concept as covering a whole record via the Ramones self-titled. Here is Chris Fields with the second track, Slogan.
Covered the full My Brain Hurts record, and he had this quote here that said, this album, referring to My Brain Hurts, is not a tribute, but a punishment for spawning so many crappy bands, such as John Cougar, Concentration Camp, and others that we are still dealing with to this day. I know that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I actually often feel that way myself, so can you just explain to me in your own words what you're saying there?
Well, I guess what I'm saying there, it's strange because that album... How long ago did that come out?
91, so...
Wow, so yeah, like 20 years? It's like, you know, from the 60s to 70s, you know, musically the world was a completely different place, and then from the 70s to the 80s, again, it's a different world of music. It just seems like from 90 till now, not a whole lot has changed musically, and it seems, you know, it seems like people are still forming bands based on that three chord. Of course, it's third-rate versions of... What was great, it's like when people say, if you like this, you'll like this, but that's never the case. I love Screeching Weasel, but I don't necessarily love bands that sound like Screeching Weasel.
As a musician, where do you fit in?
Well, when we formed John Cougar Concentration Camp, we were, you know, one of those bands, we loved Screeching Weasel, and we just wanted to sound like them. As a matter of fact, most of our first shows were 21 and up, so half of our set would be Screeching Weasel songs, and no one would know because they were all too old to get it. So they just assumed they were our songs, and we never said any different. So, you know, and then we started writing our own songs. But at the time, you know, that's where we were at musically. Now, I mean, I still love it, and that's why we recorded it. And it was a lot of fun, but it's not necessarily the kind of music I play anymore. John Cougar Concentration Camp hasn't really been a band since 99, but every once in a while we'll get together and do a show or something. The reason we did the My Brain Hurts album is because we were recording something else that went by really fast. We finished super early. We were bored and like, we just started jamming songs we knew and we're like, let's record the whole album. We just really did it for fun. And then, Livid Records said they wanted to put it out, so we said, go ahead, we don't care.
It made me reflect back on what I was doing there then. You know, we were playing simple music, but I didn't know how to make, like, the rhythm things that I was doing stand out. And I could notice that a lot of the little teeny things I was doing aren't even in your versions of it. And because there's, like, little subtleties that I expect. Like in Slogans, I had this little peel-off I do in between the notes. And it's so funny to listen to yours and almost be upset. It's like, I worked so hard on that little sound.
Yeah, and then my interpretation, you get it.
Because I was never been a guitarist that wanted to, like,
I always like turned myself down on stage, and I was never one of those like trying to overpower my sound. But I did have my little things that I was proud of.
Wow, yeah. I guess if you listen to it back to back, there's probably a ton of stuff we left out.
Yeah, no, I think that's all great. I think it's very funny, and you guys were just doing it sort of the skin of your teeth right there.
I played drums on that as well. I played drums and guitar on that album, and the drumming was actually the more difficult. Panic fills are very deliberate. Like every hit is really solid. And it's so fast, you know, when he does those, that was tough to do. And I didn't get it on a lot of it. But we just kind of did it. We said, that's good enough kind of attitude. It seems simple. And then you get behind the kit and try to do it. And you're like, wow, that takes some stamina. Like, that's not easy. And plus, we're live. You know, he's super fun to watch, too.
All right, Chris. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. All right. Take care.
Bye. I'm gonna rest and roll, don't raise bandwidth, stand up tall and proud. Don't try to tell me how the algae has nothing to do with this. Think there's so much in which wrong, I'm one big fucked up college trip.
The third track on the record is first represented by a short interview done by Dan Vavid, a member of Screeching Weasel, during the recording of My Brain Hurts. After Vavid, you will hear from Andrea from a band called The Mangies. The Mangies are an Italian-based band out of the city called La Spezia. They are one of the bands in this world that I think proudly carry the torch of punk rock.
What happened with Guest List is we were playing Guest List. I had the lead to that song because initially it was going to be a Sludgeworth song, and those guys didn't really want to play it. I kind of had like a little outline of it. And so I had shown Ben the lead, and we had played it actually a lot differently with that lead, but then just kind of dropped it. And what happened with that is that I was driving one day, and the chorus of Guest List popped in my head. It was through Roscoe Village. And I remember going to Ben and showing him the chords for it and the melody, the words and the melody for the chorus. And then we ended up putting that lead for the beginning of the song. And then I had just like a riff for the verse. And then he just kind of wrote the words around that chorus. That's how that song came about. But we were actually rehearsing it on that tour.
Guest List. I've been singing this song live many times because we covered it every night when my band was a five-piece with John Jagged on guitar back in 2002 on a US tour. I still don't know who Harvey Klinger is or what a groinorama is, but I know very well what it means to hang out at your own show feeling like a fat potato. That's how I relate to that song. I didn't know Screeching Weasel back in 1991 when My Brain Hurts came out. A few years later, in 1994, the year pop punk exploded, I was already the lead singer of the Mangies, while the drummer of another Italian punk band called The Pills came to my town to hang out with me. That was happening because the scene was small and we had no World Wide Web yet, so if you wanted to talk about music with someone with good taste, you could take a train and travel to another town sometimes. Anyway, he told me something like this. Boyade. Ma ti piacciono i gruppi alla Ramones e l'Ardons? Non conosci Screeching Weasel? Neppure Queers? De, un ci credo! That's what he told me. If I was a Ramones fan and I liked melody in punk music, I had to listen to the Screeching Weasel and the Queers. We didn't know if it was supposed to be called pop punk or punk rock or rock and roll or whatever. In the 90s in Italy, everybody's English language skills were very bad, and our favorite band was called the Ramones instead of the Ramones. Anyway, that guy left me a tape that day, one cassette with the Screeching Weasel on one side, the Queers on the other, and two or three Vindictive songs to fill the empty space. That's how I discovered the sound of 19's Lookout Records.
During a Chicago performance of a show called The Encyclopedia Show, I learned that many of my favorite solo performers in Chicago are also Weasel fans. This is where I met the talented odd fella known as Tim Stafford, and here he is presenting his musings on Veronica Hates Me.
When I was 14, I stole My Brain Hurts from my cousin Stevie. Stevie was not cool enough to own that album, and he didn't even know what it was. All he did was tag along with his friend and his friend's older brother to Rolling Stone Records near the north side of Chicago. The brother told him what to buy and picked out My Brain Hurts, a Naked Ray Gun album, and for some reason, the Soup Dragons.
Don't be afraid of your freedom!
He bought them all. His parents were going through a divorce, so he always had a wad of cash to spend on stuff he would soon forget about. That was the thing about Stevie. He forgot about everything. He would sleep over at my house, walk a half mile home, and then we'd get a call from my aunt asking us if he left his shoes, because he walked home barefoot in November. When he brought over his brand new copy of My Brain Hurts, I knew it would be mine by sundown. The common practice for kids on my street was to buy an album nobody had and then let everyone make a cassette copy of it for themselves. I asked Stevie if I could copy it, and he agreed. I started the tape and then suggested that we ride our bikes over to Bambino's in Brookfield to get hot dogs. I chose this plan for two reasons. One, I really wanted a hot dog. And two, by the time we were finished, he'd have to hurry home to make curfew, thus forgetting about the CD he had left in my stereo. Forcing my cousin to forget that album effectively doubled my punk rock collection. The only other album I owned was Operation Ivy's compilation, so for a while my mixtapes were just some combination of those two. Sometimes I would alternate one Operation Ivy song and then one Screeching Weasel song, or two and then two, but never three and three, because that would have just been wrong. My punk rock collection slowly increased through my high school years. Mixtapes were swapped, the addresses of cool record stores were located, rides to those record stores by my older brother were begged. My mixtapes became varied and radical. I didn't have to repeat any band. I had songs that nobody had ever heard of by bands that nobody had ever heard of. While my classmates were too busy studying for midterms, I was holed up in my parents' basement trying to find a perfect song to fill in the final 45 seconds of my latest creation. No matter how many tapes I made, the one constant was Veronica Hates Me. I was infatuated with the song. Somehow, this punk rocker had managed to make a girl hate him while simultaneously making her want to marry him. I was pretty good with getting girls to hate me, but the making them want to stick around part was another matter altogether. I dreamt of dating a girl named Veronica. And when we broke up, I'd send her a tape with only that song on it. Just that song and 87 empty minutes for her to use to think about how miserable her life would be without me. But there were no Veronicas at my high school. There was a Cindy, but she was in color guard, so I don't even think she knew what methadone was. My mixtape making skills increased by my senior year. I thought I was very clever when I started off a tape with Material Issue's Valerie Loves Me, then followed it immediately with Veronica Hates Me. For friends who were getting sick of the song, I let the tape run out so they thought it was at the end, and then after 3 minutes or so of dead air, it would kick in.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Veronica Hates Me has been one of my favorite songs for over half my life. It's been with me through deaths, births, breakups, and bad jobs. It's forgiven me for my past musical digressions into ska, third wave ska, punk ska, and a week or so in 1999 of electronica. And as for my cousin Stevie, he's now nearing his mid-30s and still lives in his mom's basement. And I sometimes feel guilty about that. Like, if I had never taken the album from him, he would have turned into a fully functional, well-adapted adult. It's a possibility. But then I remember his parents' ugly divorce, his undiagnosed ADD, and his general lack of motivation, and I start to feel a whole lot better about what I've done. Either way, it wouldn't really have meant that much to him. Well, at least, it wouldn't have meant as much as it did to me.
Ben Weasel and I have varying opinions on just about everything under the sun, but often we did share some similarities. We both liked songs that were about the sun, and that's why we were both attracted to the song called I Can See Clearly. Ben was attracted to the version done by Ray Charles, and I very much enjoyed the original, which was done by Johnny Nash. We eventually recorded this song, but the bridge wasn't really working for us too well. Ben and Vapid didn't seem that it flowed with the rest of the song, so they removed it. I really enjoyed this section of the song and thought it made the song strange and odd, which is something I appreciated. So I brought it back with the band Even in Blackouts. So what you are going to hear now is Even in Blackouts' version of I Can See Clearly. It will be the underscore to an interview by Larry Livermore, who was the founder of Lookout Records. He is also a journalist from Maximum Rock and Roll, and he has his own blog, and he's working on a book, and he just does about everything you possibly can do involving writing. So here is Larry Livermore interviewed over I Can See Clearly. Talking, Larry.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, John.
Was Screeching Weasel indeed the first non-California band on Lookout? And if so, why?
I remember saying at the time that they were more California than a lot of bands that actually were from California. They actually captured the sound that, you know, at least to me, was what my record label and what I considered, you know, the scene that I was part of in the Bay Area. To me, that was, you know, there was a certain ideal. And people often point out how on Lookout there was a lot of wildly different styles of music, but there was a one kind of ideal type that to me represented what Gilman and East Bay and Northern California was, you know, our late 80s version of the punk scene, what it was all about. And Screeching Weasel, like, probably expressed that sound, that feeling, that energy as well as or better than most of our local bands. So I kind of declared them an honorary Northern California band.
And did you feel that showed up on that first show that we played at Gilman?
Yeah, right away. I knew right then that this was the kind of band that I wanted to work with. However, at the time, apparently the band had already made arrangements to do its what would become its second record with another label out in Chicago. I think it was Roadkill Records. So I said, well, maybe in the future we can do something. And then, of course, the band promptly broke up right after that, and it was not possible to do anything until they got back together, trying to sort of shepherd them back together. It involved many, many long phone conversations before it was finally agreed that it would be Screeching Weasel again, which was my condition for putting them out on Lookout. Our first awareness of Screeching Weasel really came from the infamous scene reports that Ben did out in, you know, from, he would do Chicago scene reports in Maximum Rock and Roll, and then everybody from the more established punk bands would write in outraged that, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? I never even met him, and he's talking about our scene, and, you know, and he, of course, would respond that they were a bunch of old dinosaurs, and who cares what they thought, because these were the new kids. So it was more for the provocation. I would say my own feelings about the band, you know, I first got interested because of the controversy, and then once I saw them, you know, it was more about the live show than it was about the recordings.
It was about 7 a.m. in the morning a few months ago when I was in a van preparing for a puppet show in an elementary school in Indiana when I got a phone call from Mass Giorgini, confirming that he would indeed like to participate on my radio show. Mass Giorgini is one of the main crucial part of the workings and the existence of Screeching Weasel, from playing music in the band, to recording, to being a philosopher, to being a parent of the band, a fan, a supporter. So here is Mass Giorgini with his take on Cindy's on Methadone.
This is Mass Giorgini, and the song I'm here to talk about is Cindy's on methadone.
Cindy's on methadone, she's through it for something. Cindy's on methadone, she's off of heroin.
My involvement with Screeching Weasel goes back to the very beginning of the band. In fact, just after their very first album came out, I helped set up some shows in Lafayette, Indiana for the band, and they came down and played a couple of shows that I helped organize and arrange in Lafayette, but also I put together a few shows in other parts of Indiana, and we did road trips together down and back. And then I continued to stay in close touch with them. I was there for the album release party of the second album, and we maintained a close friendship. It was mainly John and I and Ben that I'm talking about here. Even into My Brain Hurts, and when it was released, in fact, my old band at the time did some dates with Screeching Weasel in Pennsylvania, which led to the band deciding to come down and record Wiggle with me at Sonic Iguana Studios, which was a brand new studio at the time. In fact, during that session, we recorded a new version of Cindy's on Methadone with another girl's name in the title. In the process of recording that song, I learned to love it even more. You learn the inner workings of a song probably best in the recording studio when you're putting down each take one at a time and listening closely to make sure the performances are good, scrutinizing every detail. You end up learning the ins and outs and the workings of a song in a way that you can't learn even in a rehearsal space practicing your part, because you do have to focus on performing in that kind of context, where if you're recording, you can listen back and try to judge it more as a listener than as a performer. I remember that I already loved the song, the original, Cindy's on Methadone, which appeared on My Brain Hurts, from the very first time I heard it. I just thought it was brilliant and ingenious, and in fact, many of us at the time knew people who had had problems with heroin and were going through rehab and had to begin the process of trying to wean themselves from heroin. And of course, there was that strange step in the middle where you basically saw people become addicted to a new drug that was somehow okay, in the, at least in the by the perspective of the doctors or the law, but yet didn't really seem to be fixing things. One of those medical situations that wasn't that different than what I saw a little bit later with my own father, with chemotherapy and radiation therapy with cancer, where you just want to poison the patient enough to kill the disease without killing them, but in the process you're also poisoning them in other ways. And I don't know, the whole methadone thing sort of struck a similar kind of place in my heart to that. But as far as the song structure itself, just amazing song, the classic pop song, very catchy, so upbeat and happy in spirit that it seems like a light, fluffy pop song, yet the message is anything but. It's definitely full of socio-political criticism, if you will, even though maybe the way most people look at Screeching Weasel has never been as a socio-political critique band. The truth is they're always had that kind of message throughout their songs, and even the happiest of songs, by nature of being performed the way they were, with sort of an irreverent spirit and the rough-edged punk rock tone, and of course Ben's voice, which even when singing a pretty song had a certain amount of snarling bite to it, really sort of turns the whole pop punk formula on end. And I think this song is an excellent example of that, and also one of the masterpieces of Screeching Weasel lore and history, if you will. I'm very proud of having been involved in everything I've done with Screeching Weasel, which of course is a long, long history from being a member of the band for almost 9 years and producing or engineering a large number of the releases, starting from Wiggle all the way through Teen Punks and Heat. And I have to admit that I can't find too many points in the history that really defeat My Brain Hurts, even though that's one that I, you know, wasn't personally involved with. It's a high point of the band, and sure, I can find ways in which certain songs later are equal or better than some songs on My Brain Hurts to me, or obviously sonically there have been higher points than My Brain Hurts, but the truth is, it's hard to beat the collection of songs and the spirit that's there on that album.
You could probably create a game show just based on all the references that are made in Screeching Weasel songs and in the history of Weasel itself. One which has affected one of the most complex songs on a Weasel record is a reference to Joseph Campbell and his studying of mythology. Here is Jim Testa, creator and journalist for Jersey Beat and a well-known blogger and podcaster himself, with his study of Science of Myth.
This is about the Science of Myth by Screeching Weasel. I probably heard the Science of Myth live, maybe even a couple of times, before I heard the version of the song that appears on My Brain Hurts, which I believe remains Screeching Weasel's most popular album. I really don't remember. But it was only when I had the lyrics in front of me that the song really made an impact. What struck me first was the sheer audacity of a punk band like Screeching Weasel making a song out of what was basically a political screed. True, there's a bit of a chorus that repeats once or twice. But these lyrics really read more like an essay than a set of verses and choruses, especially given how closely most other Screeching Weasel songs hew to the very basic song structures employed by the Ramones and countless rock and roll songwriters before them. Before we go any further, I should probably introduce myself. My name is Jim Testa, and I was the editor of Jersey Beat. Yeah, that Jersey Beat, the one name dropped in My Friends Are Getting Famous. Russ Forster from Underdog Records and I had struck up a friendship years and years ago in the early 80s. We were pen pals, really, since this was all before there was an internet, and he had sent me the first self-titled Screeching Weasel album to review. It impressed me so much, it was so different from anything else that was happening back in 1987, that I flew out to Chicago for a vacation, and I got to see the original lineup of Screeching Weasel with Vinnie Bovine and Steve Cheese at a club called Dirty Nelly's. That's where I met Screeching Weasel. I'm pretty sure I hold the world record for seeing the most different incarnations of Screeching Weasel. I saw them with Brian Vermin and Warren Osfish on the Boogada tour in a damp, dark, cold basement in New York City when there was nobody else there. And then about a year later, at a triumphant show at ABC No Rio, when Dan Vapid and Gubb were in the band. I was lucky enough to see the classic lineup, with Vapid and Panic, at their home base of McGregor's quite a few times in the 90s. And then when Ben reformed the band in 2000 with Mance Giorgini and Zach Damon, I saw that lineup at Chicago's House of Blues. After a while, Ben decided to come back to live performing, and he played with a couple of backup bands at Insubordination Fest. I was there for that. And then he put together a band that wasn't called Screeching Weasel, but they played the entirety of My Brain Hurts at Reggie's Rock Club. I was not only there for that, I got to introduce them.
Ladies and gentlemen, the grouchiest man in the world, Ben Weasel!
And I was even there at South by Southwest in 2011. So let's just say that I know me some Screeching Weasel. Which brings us back to the Science of Myth. I know Ben toyed with Buddhism for a while, and then later converted to Catholicism. But the Science of Myth, the song, seems to suggest, it's right there in the title, that all religion is a myth. You ought to realize that every myth is a metaphor, it says. But unlike the typical agnostic or atheist, who not only disbelieve in religion, but actively disdain it, the song suggests there's a place for religion. Simple truth is that it's none of that, and somehow, no matter what, the world keeps turning, somehow we get by without ever learning. Those words hit hard in 1989, but think about what they mean today, at a time when politicians cravenly use religion to push their own political agendas, when a person's faith is questioned, if they dare to challenge accepted teachings about such fundamental issues as homosexuality, or birth control, or gay marriage. There are even members of Congress actively pressing for the public schools to teach creationism and the idea that the earth is only a few thousand years old, because that's what it says in the Bible, in our public schools. Read between the line in this election, and there's even the thinly veiled suggestion that a belief in global warming is somehow anti-Christian. The Science of Myth was written well before technologies like stem cell research or the ability to clone a human being raised important ethical issues. But those questions have always been around, the question of faith versus science. I mean, look at the atom bomb. No one suggests that belief systems aren't important. Without them, we risk blindly rushing into technological nightmares that would make even the rampaging dinosaurs of Jurassic Park seem insignificant. Science looks for answers. Myth suggests there are no absolute truths. That is the paradox of the human experience. That is what the science of myth is all about.
Once again, if you had listened to this podcast live when it was considered a radio show, you would have experienced questions and stories from fans. So please, that is a reason to tune in live. It is almost or probably every third Friday of the month. Just check my website on the actual dates. Also, if you're listening to this between October 22nd and Halloween, you can actually purchase my book, The Last Temptation of Clarence Oddbody, via ebook for free at Amazon.com. It is free for the next 10 days to help boost its appearance in search engines, which will eventually lead to sales. The important part to me is that all of the money that comes in for this book, I donate directly back into putting out other theater companies and musicians on the publishing company Hope and Non-Things. So, moving on. Kyle Kinane, stand-up comedian, amazing. I saw him with Patton Oswalt with my girlfriend Paige Saliba. You can read about that on my blog called Memories of a Jughead. Kyle Kinane is an incredible comedian who I also found out is a Chicago punk fan. So here is Kyle Kinane espousing on what we hate.
This is Kyle Kinane, and I will be discussing the song What We Hate. I saw Screeching Weasel for the first time at McGregor's on Valentine's Day of 1993, and it was the first show that somebody took me to in high school. I was 16 years old. The only concert I'd been to previously was Poison and Warrant in the eighth grade. So I didn't know about any type of punk rock music or anything. I had no introduction to it. And a friend took me to McGregor's, which happened was the last night McGregor's would be doing shows. So Screeching Weasel, Bo Weevil, Smoking Popes, and The Vindictives were playing. And it sold out. There was a huge line. We got there. I was like, I've never heard of these guys. They're not on the radio, and they're not on MTV. So I don't know why there'd be this many people. So that was my first indication of just seeing, like, oh, this can be done without traditional methods. There's hundreds and hundreds of people here, to the point that they had to put a second show on. Screeching Weasel played a second show, and that's the show we got in to see. I remember waiting in line, having to still wait in line through the first show. I was freezing, and the doors opened, and I heard the guitar solo from what I would find out would be the song Supermarket Fantasy. And I was like, right there, I was like, oh, I think I could play that on my guitar. And so instantly it became accessible to me, because I think I could play that music myself. I could like look at it and figure it out. And there was still all these people that are see it. So I went, saw a show, and I just had never experienced anything like it. And it was fantastic. It was this whole new world of music that, you know, once you go to one show, you just got the flyers and you find, where's the next one? Oh, they're all here in the suburbs. I can get to all these. So I bought everything I could by Screeching Weasel, money allowing it at the time. And I got the album My Brain Hurts, superior album. The song What We Hate, though, scared the shit out of me. The lyrics of What We Hate, I think one of the strongest roles of dictating how I live my life now, because it seemed, you know, dystopian, blah, 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 blah. songs like that about, you know, jaded youth and everything. But this was actually, in a way, predicted the future for several people. I was already, you know, seeing people in high, like, you're already planning out your life. You're already planning on going to college and marrying when you're done with college. I'm like, we're 17 years old right now. How are you having that planned out? And the line, young once, old forever, which my friend Marco actually got tattooed on him. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. This is it. This is all we have. So I made zero rush in maturing or growing up or trying to just give up on whatever pathetic dreams. I took the song as a warning because the song was almost basically like, you're gonna give up on what you believe in. And I was like, I'm not going to. I held fast that I would not give up on it. And because of that, I'm sure I made some certain sacrifices that are not heartbreaking because now I'm 35. I found out what I wanted to do and I pursued my ridiculous dreams of being a comedian. And it worked. I'm here and I get to do this for a living in huge part because of listening to punk lyrics like What We Hate telling me that your future is going to, you're going to fall in line. You're going to become the same thing as your parents. Not that that's bad. They're good people. But I knew that that wasn't the plan for my life. I didn't know what the plan was, which is an intimidating, scary part when you're, you know, graduating high school and then you're forced to make a decision to go to a college. You just finished fooling around. Now pick what you're going to do for life. And I went to three different colleges and farted around and I allowed myself to find what I wanted and find what I love so I did not become what I hate. Realizing that your life doesn't matter is actually a hopeful point of that song because it means you get to do whatever you want. I took it that way. I took it in a much more hopeful thing. Not that, oh, your life doesn't matter, that you wouldn't make an impact, or that it means you get to do what you want. You know, go have fun. It doesn't matter in the most positive sense. It doesn't matter in the fact that it's yours. Have fun with it. Do with it what you want. So I took the song as a cautionary tale. I believe heeded the warning accordingly. And now here I am driving through the high desert of Utah on a stand-up comedy tour, which I designed much in the way that bands would design their tour of just networking and getting out there and meeting new people and seeing the country.
Since I figure you wanted more than just a taste of an interview with Dan Vapid, I have saved a bit more of it for this section right now for the following two songs. Dan Vapid has been in many bands as a writer, singer, bassist, guitarist for the Methadones, Screeching Weasel, The Queers, Dan Vapid and the Cheats, and an old hardcore band called Generation Waste. He is a co-writer of the next two songs. So here is Dan Vapid talking about his days in the band during My Brain Hurts to take the place of Teenage Freak Show and Kamala's Too Nice.
First song that you remember, what was the first one writing with Ben?
Well, it was that one with the bass that went like, it didn't really have words, it went no, da 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 da, whoa. And we didn't have words for it, and he came up with a part that was pretty cool, but we never recorded it. So that one I remember being first, and then probably Kamala's Too Nice and Fathead. The one that I remember really clearly was Teenage Freak Show because I had the whole song, but it was called Teenage Peep Show. It was just kind of stupid. And he heard it and he really liked it and just changed it to Teenage. Teenage Freak Show. So I remember that really well, and I remember Guest List really well.
In going into My Brain Hurts, we had already recorded before, like we had talked about Fathead slogans and I Want to Be Homosexual. My memories for this record specifically start with What We Hate, for some reason, sticks out in my mind. I remember being in Dan Panic's basement, and I don't know if it's in retrospect, but I actually did feel it. It seems like I felt at that moment that there was something special about these songs we were doing and about this band at that time period. Does that feel like a feeling or a memory you might have had at that time period?
Yeah, absolutely. But I felt like the band had something really special before that record, which was Bugatta. So by the time I had really thought the band was going to do really well. I don't know if you guys did really at the time, but like I remember thinking, I was like, wow, this is going to be a really good record for these guys. And I remember being very excited even before that. So like by the time I had joined, you know, it's funny in retrospect. Back then, I used to think that Bugatta was better than My Brain Hurts for a long time when I first started. I was like, oh man, it's not as good as Bugatta, 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 man, you know, and I sometimes get a little bummed about it, but now looking back now, I don't think that way anymore, but, you know, but saying that, I still really did feel like, yeah, it was like a really cool thing. It was a really good dynamic. I felt like as far as, the band I should be playing in, that was it. Musically speaking, you know, I felt like I really clicked with Ben in a lot of ways. You know, there was some really good chemistry. I was able to like just kind of throw in backing vocals, and you know, you guys seemed really receptive to that. I thought that kind of gave it like a new dynamic. So I was really kind of excited to be a part of something and have you know, to throw ideas out there and have them, you know, be heard and appreciated. Because usually, you know, before that, my other band, Generation Waste, was kind of not like that. You know, it was like if I had an idea, it'd be like, oh, look at Dan's got an idea, isn't that cute? You know, so this was the first band where it was like, no, that's a really good idea, I really like that, you know. And I remember getting a lot of encouragement from you and Larry Livermore, even Dan Panic, you know, about, you know, the contribution. So I thought that was so that was really important to me. But yeah, this to the music that we were doing, I thought was really important to me as well, because it was, you know, more along the lines of what I've been trying to do for a while. Dan Panic does a lot of stuff on, you know, with drumming that most drummers don't do even, you know. He's usually slightly ahead of the beat, where most drummers I know are slightly behind the beat. There is a little spastic quality to when he's playing.
What do you remember from the getting ready for the trip to California, the tour, and then actually recording My Brain Hurts in a tour?
I remember just thinking it was neat that we were recording in San Francisco, I guess, because I had done some recordings at that point, but not a lot. And, you know, to be on a record was like a big deal, you know, but to be on a record, but then be on a record of it's something that I would actually listen to was a really big deal for me, you know. And to be a contributor of that was a really big deal to me. Very larger than life to me at the time, in its own little way.
Did you feel any pressure going in to record those songs?
Well, I don't remember any pressure. I remember thinking at the time that I was a guitar. I never played guitar on an album, so, and here I am playing guitar, and I didn't know if I could pull it off, but pull it off okay.
You had said earlier that you weren't really too surprised about how well the band was going to be doing, but were you at all surprised when we went to gigs like a little bit later and all of a sudden audiences were singing our songs, like places we had never been before?
No, not that much. I thought the band had that in them since Bugatta. I really felt that there was it was done well enough that it would grow, and it did.
Do you have either like favorites on the record or favorites that you think that you're proud of having written?
Yeah, I mean, Guest List is one of those, and Teenage Freak Show for that record. Then, like, just a song. I really like the song What We Hate.
What is it about What We Hate that there's something that I can't even place? It's almost like a, you know, we sort of write anthem songs in some ways, or Ben writes a lot of, I don't know if it's the chord progression or what it is, but that song, and the lyrics too, are just very powerful.
Well, that's what really does it for me. I just think it's just really well written. I just don't understand how, you know, even, like, I think I like that song more now than I did then, because I just don't see how someone that young could write that.
Yeah.
It seems like something that would come from being older, you know.
Having been in the band from the beginning, I knew that when you came in, there was a sort of, not even just like friendship bond, but like an understanding of a goal in music. And I just don't know if you had felt that with him, or what you thought that might be.
Yeah, no. I definitely felt that. I felt that very strongly. I felt like I really clicked, and I knew where he was coming from. And in fact, it was one of those things, I thought a lot of times it was unspoken. Like, he would have a part, I would throw a backing vocal, and he would look at me and would, you know, nod, yeah. I think it comes from wanting to do the same thing and just kind of having the same sensibility about it or something. It just clicked somehow.
Yeah,
I've never really found that chemistry since, actually, with anybody. But we had it more in the early days, or like later on, by the time Anthem had come around, he was a little more solitary of when he would write.
Next, I like to call them the Telfers 2. It is the Telfer brothers who came to Chicago and took it by drizzle, but it will be a storm soon. Dan Telfer is a stand-up comedian, an actor and writer, illustrator, husband, and daddy. He has a new CD out called Tendrils of Ruin. And his brother Rob Q. Telfer is a performance artist and is the co-host of The Encyclopedia Show. Here are the two of them working together since the first time they left home, never to return to their bunk beds. Here is Dan and Robbie Q. Telfer with their insight into Don't Turn Out the Lights.
Some songs happen to you exactly when they should. I heard Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire precisely at the height of my interest in rock songs about major world events told chronologically. I heard Boris the Sprinkler's Drugs and Masturbation right when I needed to know punk was possible, and Screeching Weasel's Don't Turn Out the Lights was my point of no return. Incidentally, my brother Dan was the reason I heard any of those songs. At that point, I couldn't really be sure music existed if it hadn't passed through his hands first.
I was always confused as to why people liked pop music. My junior high art teacher was obsessed with Poison and Billy Joel. A classmate said to me, "Admit it, you loved Vanilla Ice back in the day. Everyone did." No, I didn't. I hated pretty much everything because everything was pop music. I'll never forget when, in the Boys to Men song, End of the Road, the one dude romantically recalls how he didn't care his woman was sneaking out on him. What the hell was going on with people that they could listen to this? Sometimes They Might Be Giants cheered me up, but it wasn't until I got in my friend Ryan's Ford Focus and he put Descendants, then Screeching Weasel tapes in the stereo that I stopped resenting music.
Don't Turn Out the Lights became an essential anthem for me, especially because Dan had put it on that mixtape. We had the same basic upbringing, the same basic DNA, the same basic unfortunate haircuts. The main tension in Don't Turn Out the Lights is the vacillation between imagined fears in the dark and the real fears of neglect and abandonment from which the imaginary ones are born. I would not say Dan and I were neglected in the same way the narrator is in the song, but we were neglected in a larger sense by a suburban dream we were sold that never seemed to materialize for us. Indeed, I'm constantly surprised by people who seem comfortable in living that polystyrene suburban lifestyle, sprawling into the horizon, consuming the planet like a flesh-eating bacteria.
I liked Don't Turn Out the Lights because it had no swears in it. Oh, I loved swears. They were and still are the best. If you don't love swears, you are an imbecile. But I worked at my high school radio station as both the music coordinator who wrote the DJ playlists for all the DJs, and I had my own DJ shift. So for a full year, I played during my DJ shift Screeching Weasel, Boris the Sprinkler, Mr. T Experience, and Jawbreaker because I wrote all the playlists and because I could play whatever I want. When the swears would come on, I would manually lower the volume, something you were never supposed to do. I knew where every swear was, though, and eventually, my boss noticed I was playing songs that were not approved by the school board, and that my playlists were different from the other DJ playlists, which was a no-no at Homewood Flossmoor High School's WHFH. We were the biggest student radio station in the world, but we were still kids. I lost my DJ shift, but I did not learn any lessons.
In our suburb, Homewood, Illinois, home of the now legendary venue Off the Alley, one had to align oneself either as a Bad Religion punk or a Screeching Weasel punk. It was very liberating being able to discern artificiality even in our little suburban subculture. For us, Screeching Weasel was the only authentic art we knew, and it constantly dared us further and further into the darkness of the city, of ourselves. And Bad Religion was a bunch of fucking sellouts. I have a couple of bullshit theories about why there's no good art in the suburbs. One being that because suburbanites' entire existence is dedicated to swallowing and maintaining such a fictional existence, they have little imaginative energy left for actual fiction and harmless or useful forms of magical thinking. Don't Turn Out the Lights is the moment a young person realizes their parents, or in my case, capitalism, can't protect us like all the paper towel commercials say they can.
I went to dozens and dozens of punk shows in high school, mostly by myself. I chatted up the girls, ran away from fights, and spent most of my time sitting on top of amplifiers while the real punk kids moshed beneath me. I drew some comic strips that went in some zines. I got a most improved trophy from my bass guitar instructor and was briefly in a band called the Inflatable Dates. But mostly, I had no idea what was going on socially and was a loud, irritating spaz. One time, a singer in a band, who was 8 years older than me, stole my girlfriend. Then, when I told my ex-girlfriend the true story of how I once saw him blow another dude in the club green room, he threatened to publicly stab me, and I stopped going to shows for a while.
Another bullshit theory that we were all so angry because we realized that we were gonna die, eventually, of course. The lights being turned out permanent-like is a realization that goes well with teen angst. I remember not being able to sleep as a child, just watching one more TV show, saying one more thing to Dan as I stared up at the underside of his mattress. But after George Michael's Sports Machine ended at 1 a.m. on NBC, there really wasn't anything on TV. Dan would stop responding to my inane questions, and I'd learn to refrain from wandering out of bed because the parents wouldn't tolerate my slumber stalling. That moment, the final stretch before the lights go out, is when we are most alone. At the end of the song, a repetitive desperation sinks in as Ben sings, "Say you care. Say you care," over and over without response. Just the echo of the imperative bouncing around in our heads, off the top bunk, stealing us each night to the new America we'd wake up to tomorrow.
When I was on the top bunk as a little kid, all I could think about were my awesome spaceship bedsheets and how I wished I could look at them. My Star Wars action figures. If only I could play with them. As my little brother kicked my mattress for hours on end, I became furious that I was expected to go to sleep. This was as good as it was going to get. These were the salad days. I clung to those visions of Johnny Carson, then David Letterman, then the sports version of George Michael, and that delightful late-night sprite, Sandman Sims. One day, I knew I would wake up, and I'd be out of playtime. But as long as I was awake, I was still one day younger.
This next track, I think, sort of sticks out like a sore thumb on a hand of wonderfulness. It's still a very good song, but it feels like it has a whole different flavor, and that's probably because it was one of the earlier songs written prior to the recording of this record. I chose not to have this piece done by friends of mine, but to talk about it very shortly myself. Very often, I felt I had to protect the idea that Screeching Weasel wasn't just a three-chord punk band, sugary, sweet, pop songwriting machine, that we had some girth, texture, and levels, and complexity. When I told this to my friend Spike, he said, oh, okay. And then about a week later, he said that he picked up My Brain Hurts, and he came to me and he said, what exactly is the philosophical meaning of punky, 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 go fart in a puddle? So that's that for this track called Fathead. Moving on, here we have Dan Panic. I interviewed Dan Panic a few weeks back. He's one of my favorite people to talk to. We can just chat on for hours and hours and bore people to sleep. Luckily, I got him and I on a good day where we got quite a bit of information out of him about his days in Screeching Weasel, and specifically during My Brain Hurts. So here is Dan Panic, a man of many bands, the Queers, the Riverdales, the Groovy Ghoulies, the Plus Ones, Beulah, Screeching Weasel, and Ivy League. His interview will take the place of the song I Wanna Be With You Tonight, for no particular reason other than it seemed a good place to put his interview.
Yeah, we actually played with you guys, because it was Ivy League, Apocalypse Hoboken, and you guys. When I saw you guys play live, I really liked the humor, dressing up in ridiculous clothes, then baiting the audience and watching people get really annoyed and upset.
Yeah, I remember us, Ben and I, both being impressed with your drumming that night, because we had, I think even at that gig, we had discussed reforming the band, because we were together for that show just to help pay back Russ Forster on Underdog Records. So I remember seeing you drum and being very impressed, but I would like your opinion of how did you end up in Screeching Weasel.
I had gotten Ben's phone number from him, and I remember talking to him sporadically over a short period of time, and once Ivy League broke up, I thought that was going to be it for me for drumming. And then I was looking to do something different, but he had mentioned that he was going to put a project together and if I was going to be interested in doing it. And like I said, I really like Screeching Weasel's music, so I'm like, sure, I'd be interested. And I didn't really think that anything would come of it because I was an unknown, you know, person in the punk scene. So I was really surprised when I got a phone call and we all got together and played.
I think from the beginning, we started rehearsing at your house, is that correct?
I think we did two rehearsals at Dave Lally's house. And then I think his father wasn't too keen on the idea, so we went over to my folks' house.
Do you remember at any... Because you were a very lively drummer and just your expressions and all that. Was there any forethought, or that just sort of happened, that you're restricted to being behind drums? What did that feel like to you?
I think it just kind of happened. I think just with the attitude of everyone else in the band and having a sense of humor. And I think it was my way of communicating with people in the audience, because I didn't really care to be... You know, sometimes you see a band live and they wouldn't even acknowledge the audience. And I felt like, you know, I want to acknowledge the audience. I want to make people laugh if I can. And it's, again, kind of mocking the whole thing of being on stage and you're supposed to be a rock star. And so I think for me it was an amalgamation of sort of the humor of the band and making fun of the whole thing of being on stage and acknowledging the audience at the same time.
What were some of the things that you think that you tried to do behind the drums while you could still be drumming?
Whatever I could. I was probably busy trying to play the two drum beats that I knew. I stood on my drums before, I think during the St. Hawaii. The Wipeout middle section. And I was surfing on the drums, jumping on them to running around them.
I remember you running around the drums too, yeah. It was pretty great that you can get back to the rhythms and allow yourself to be so goofy.
Yeah, there were times where I didn't think I'd make it in time. Like, oh, I really put myself in the suit now. Like, I got 0.1 seconds to get over there and finish the song.
We had already recorded with Weasel Fathead slogans and I Want to Be a Homosexual before you were in the band. Did we just give you a tape of those and you learned them, or did we teach you live? Do you have any recollection?
Ben actually gave me a tape of those songs, and I just learned them. I learned them exactly the way that they were recorded. With any song that I learned, I tried to emulate what the drummer was doing on there, and there were a few changes here and there, but not too many. I remember our first practice, I had a couple of extra cymbals too. I remember we played the first couple of songs, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to need this cymbal. And I play a couple more, like, I'm not going to need this cymbal. To give myself some credit, you know, I'm kind of a drummer who hates drums. I've never wanted a big drum kit or drum solo or anything like that. I just wanted to play what was needed. I knew that I probably wouldn't go down in music history as one of the great drummers of all time, but I didn't really care. My attitude was just play what was needed and pretty much nothing more. I didn't expect to do anything with music. Like, my only goal was to record an album and do one tour. So once My Brain Hurts was done and we did the tour, you know, I was all ready to hang it up because I thought, okay, I guess I'm done now. I didn't expect to carry on with it. You know, I'd get people asking me to, hey, would you mind doing this and mind doing that? And I thought, well, yeah, you know, and I grabbed just about any opportunity that I had because I just figured I'm going to wake up one day and that's it. You know, because I really didn't expect to have any shelf life on the counter as far as drumming, since there's 1.5 million drummers out there in just as many bands. My whole thing is that I figure time's a ticking and...
Do it while you can, huh?
Exactly.
My memories for the My Brain Hurts records specifically start with learning What We Hate, which is my favorite song on the record. And I know I have images of us in your basement, or at least in retrospect, that's where I got this feeling that there was something special about this song and about this group and its incarnation. Do you have any moments that you can recollect where you thought that, wow, there's something special about this group of people?
What really cemented it was when the recording was finished and we were at that punk house in Oakland and we were listening to it on someone's boombox and just listening to the final album. I thought, wow. I mean, it's probably my favorite Screeching Weasel album. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of us were expected to turn out any significant member of society. So it was kind of nice to do something like this and kind of show people that I don't think there was high aspirations for any of us in society. So it was kind of nice to have this and say, yeah, you know what? These things can happen if you apply yourself. I wanna be with you now.
I chose My Brain Hurts out of the records for us because of it actually is the most popular, and it had a lot of those memories of us first getting together, I think, which are great. But I also have, like, Wiggle for me was where I felt like we as a band sort of bonded more. Remember, we just had these rehearsals where you and me and Lise Bapp, and I think Johnny Personality was in the band then. And we would just go for hours sometimes. You know, Ben would eventually leave and we'd just keep playing. That's one of the few times in my life where I actually like being involved in that sort of, you know, where we just sort of jammed.
Yeah, I think it was kind of nice. I think we just kind of needed it because I think there was such pressure to try to follow up My Brain Hurts. I think we all felt it. And I felt recording Wiggle was, for me, a lot more tense than it was for My Brain Hurts. I remember almost quitting playing music during the sessions of Wiggle because there was this drum fill that I just couldn't get, like the sticking, and I kept hitting the sticks and I'd lose the drum fill. And I think we did like 4 or 5 takes of the song and I just couldn't get it. And for me, 4 or 5 takes was 3 or 4 too many. I was really critical of my drumming and still am, but you know, I didn't want to waste other people's time, so I got really frustrated that this was taking multiple takes. And I remember Mass saying, let's go take a timeout. And I remember the Sonic Iguana Studios being near a golf course. And I think I sat on one of the holes staring into the sky for about 10, 15 minutes, wondering if I should just pack it in and tell you guys, you know what, I'm done.
The song that closes the record is the song that is the title of the record. It is My Brain Hurts. Someone asked what the cover had to do with the concepts behind the record, and I explained that it had to do with the obsession that many punk bands have with the 50s on how everything looked happy on the outside and everything was decaying on the inside. In many ways, punk became the scab that eventually surfaced out of the oozing goodness of the 50s. I think a lot of the punk bands thought we were experiencing that again in the 80s under Reagan, so that probably has something politically to do with it too. Anyway, here is one of the most genuine in the punk world these days, Cody Templeman of the Lillingtons and Teenage Bottle Rocket, with his version iPhone recording of Thoughts on My Brain Hurts.
Hey, what's up? This is Cody from Teenage Bottle Rocket and the Lillingtons. When I was first getting into a lot of the newer punk rock bands, I had a friend who let me borrow a cassette tape that he had recorded of a radio broadcast that had a bunch of stuff on it, like stuff I'd never heard before, like Operation Ivy and The Offspring, Bad Religion, Mr. T Experience. And one of the songs that was on that tape was I Want to Be a Homosexual by Screeching Weasel, which I, you know, was really stoked on. And so I went to the record store and I bought a copy of My Brain Hurts on cassette and pretty much fell in love right away. You know, the music was awesome, and just the way the cassette looked, you know, the layout had a real cut and paste feel to me, and it was cool because it made it seem like, you know, you could be in a band and you could release records on your own. You didn't have to have somebody else do all that stuff for you, and that was really cool. And also the song My Brain Hurts I really liked because I felt like I could relate to it, as far as like in the verses when Ben's singing about alienation and just not feeling like you don't fit into the rest of the society around you and stuff. I had social anxiety really bad when I was in high school and when I got out of high school, and so it was cool hearing that song and hearing those words and realizing that I wasn't the only person who felt that way. And another line from that song that's always stuck with me was, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. And I think that pertains a lot, you know, in my everyday life, as far as like just going to work, making sure things get done and done, you know, to my standards and stuff. Like, best way to do that is to just do it myself. It was also inspiring, you know, being a band from Wyoming. We didn't really have opportunities that, like, bands in bigger cities had, you know. So we had to, you know, find a place where we could record our songs. We had to find a place that would, you know, manufacture cassettes at the time is what we did. And we did the layout ourselves, you know, paid for it all ourselves. And we had to find promoters, book our own tours and all that stuff. I think because of that song, that's a lot of the reason that I ended up playing in a band today.
I bet now you're saying to yourself, hey, that's the end of the record, because I've listened to that 1,000 times, and that's the end of the record, whether you're listening to the vinyl or the CD. Well, you're right. But here's a little story embedded in a furthering of the interview of Larry Livermore with the bonus track, I Wanna Be a Homosexual.
Thank you for talking, Larry.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, John.
Was Screeching Weasel indeed the first non-California band on Lookout? And if so, why?
I remember saying at the time that they were more California than a lot of bands that actually were from California. They actually captured the sound that, you know, at least to me, was what my record label and what I considered, you know, the scene that I was part of in the Bay Area. To me, that was, you know, there was a certain ideal. And people often point out how on Lookout there was a lot of wildly different styles of music, but there was a one kind of ideal type that to me represented what Gilman and East Bay and Northern California was, you know, our late 80s version of the punk scene, what it was all about. And Screeching Weasel, like, probably expressed that sound, that feeling, that energy as well as or better than most of our local bands. So I kind of declared them an honorary Northern California band.
And did you feel that showed up on that first show that we played at Gilman?
Yeah, right away. I knew right then that this was the kind of band that I wanted to work with. However, at the time, apparently the band had already made arrangements to do its what would become its second record with another label out in Chicago. I think it was Roadkill Records. So I said, well, maybe in the future we can do something. And then, of course, the band promptly broke up right after that, and it was not possible to do anything until they got back together. Trying to sort of shepherd them back together involved many, many long phone conversations before it was finally agreed that it would be Screeching Weasel again, which is what was my condition for putting them out on Lookout. Our first awareness of Screeching Weasel really came from the infamous scene reports that Ben did out in, you know, from, he would do Chicago scene reports in Maximum Rock and Roll, and then everybody from the more established punk bands would write in outraged that, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? I never even met him, and he's talking about our scene, and, you know, and he, of course, would respond that they were a bunch of old dinosaurs, and who cares what they thought, because these were the new kids. So it was more for the provocation. I would say my own feelings about the band, you know, they were, I first got interested because of the controversy, and then once I saw them, you know, it was more about the live show than it was about the recordings. It was recorded at a studio called The Art of Ears, just on the fringe of the Haight-Ashbury, and it was in a basement, very small, very DIY. And the guy, Andy Ernst, had never, until we started coming to him, he had basically barely ever worked with punk rock bands. He'd done a lot of hip-hop, a lot of classic rock, and all sorts of things. Our first work with him was actually the first Green Day album. They were just kids then, I mean, literally, like 17, 18 years old, and they went in there and knocked it out basically an afternoon. At that time, I had this, I have to criticize myself and say it was probably an unfortunate tendency. I like to gently tease the bands and pit them against each other and say, oh, well, such and such band did this, and, you know, and one of the, you know, one of the things I bragged about was how cheaply Green Day had recorded their first album, which was, in fact, $675, I think. And Ben seemed to take that as a challenge. He was determined to go into the same studio and do his album as cheap or close to as cheap as Green Day. He didn't quite make it. I think the total bill came in at maybe $975 or something like that for the record. We recorded it in one day and mixed it the second day. Still pretty remarkable for a full-length album, especially since you were doing three extra songs for that compilation. But in all of my work in studios and with bands, I very seldom had an experience with a band that came in so thoroughly prepared, and just like every every detail. There was little notes and things. And a number of the songs were just basically one take, sometimes two or three. But I was just like kind of awestruck that they could, you guys were relatively young at the time. Right. And it was a very disciplined operation. Although I was greatly honored to have my name on the record as producer of what I consider one of the great all-time punk records, I almost in some ways felt kind of guilty because there was so little that I had to do because the band was so well prepared. This almost was taken to a fault. Ben was so determined to keep it cheap. Now, at several points when I said, I think we could do a little bit better on that take, or we could add a little bit of something there, it was almost always, no, we can't afford it. You know, we're not going to sell enough records to cover, we'll be lucky to sell enough records to cover this bill, let alone, doing any fancy stuff.
I think one of our elements that Ben and I always talked about was playing almost past our skill, so that it has that sort of energy of trying to keep up with ourselves. And I think that whole time in that studio, I felt like that, because the sound in the headphones wasn't quite right. I couldn't hear Ben, but I loved how it came out at the end of the day.
I think that's a very good way of expressing it, trying to play just a bit past your skill, because, you were not a highly technically gifted band. You were just a very well-rehearsed band with a single-pointed vision.
Since it is in the context of the record, I sort of wanted to have you in the place of where I Want to Be a Homosexual would have been on the record. So I want to quickly, you wanted that on the record. Can you just speak briefly about that, if there is anything to say about it?
I have to make some sense of context. For your younger listeners, they probably won't be aware of this, but at that time, CDs were still a fairly new thing on the punk scene, and there was quite a lot of controversy about are CDs punk, much the same as you'll get in more recent years about digital or whatever. But there was a lot of name calling and accusations like, if you put out a CD, you're a sellout, and I kind of was into that. But by the time the Screeching Weasel came to Lookout, I had concluded that, a record label was no longer going to be viable if it did not put out CDs. Things were changing that fast. I had put out a couple CDs on for Lookout bands and realized that that's mostly what people were buying. And so Ben did not want to put out My Brain Hurts on CD. I insisted that he had to, and he acquiesced. He said, well, you're the label. But he was convinced that it wouldn't sell enough to justify the extra expense of the CD release. But in that context, at that time, CDs were kind of considered dubiously punk, or not punk by the official punks. There was this sense that, and also because they cost more at that time, they usually cost a dollar or two more than records, there was this sense that unless you put on a bunch of bonus tracks to fill up the extra space, punks were like, well, if they're 73 minutes, then you got to fill it all up. So it was rare for a punk CD not to have bonus tracks. That's where I Want to Be a Homosexual and the other two tracks would have gone, is that bonus tracks only on the CD. There wouldn't have been room for them on the vinyl LP. And it turned into quite a squabble. I think that, as I recall, Ben and the other members of Screeching Weasel were quite content to have those come as bonus tracks on the CD release of My Brain Hurts. But the young guy who was putting out the, I think what became called Pervo Devo 7-inch, which is what those tracks were for, he insisted militantly that they couldn't go on Lookout release. I got very irate about that. I mean, I had made the offer that Lookout would pay for all of the recordings, so he would have no recording costs for his release in exchange for us being allowed to use them on the CD. And since he was only doing vinyl and not a CD release, they wouldn't be competing with him. But this was his first release on his new label, and it was a specifically queercore label, and he wanted to sort of hash out his own identity and not be lumped in with Lookout, which to him, I think he was about 19 or 20 years old at the time. To him, we were already the old boys. Our label had been around for like 3 years already. So, and he was pretty militant about it, and I was pretty upset, because to me, the song, especially I Want to Be a Homosexual, that was like the greatest gay anthem ever written, whether by a straight or a gay person. I felt that it was a statement that I wanted to make on Lookout, and I was being frustrated in my desires, and I remember almost being on the verge of tears at one point arguing with this kid, who's now, of course, a grown man, and I've seen him over the years. I ran into him in San Francisco about 3 or 4 years ago, and he's a great big burly guy with a mustache now, and we had kind of a laugh about it. I still wish, in a way, we could have released it, because the song needed to be heard more.
And that is the end of Jughead's Basement, My Brain Hurts, Episode 2, The Revenge of Return Strikes Again. I hope you have enjoyed this journey. If you are interested in interviews that were done with Larry Livermore, Dan Panic, and Dan Vapid, they each were about a half hour to 45 minutes long in length, uncut. We will be releasing those as separate podcasts over the next few weeks, so stay tuned for those. And also, tune in next month when we will be featuring Double Nickels on the Dime by the Minutemen. Then, we will take off December, and for January and February, we will bring you Operation Ivy's Energy and Tom Waits' Rain Dogs. This last song is from Screeching Weasel, called Mary is an Anarchist.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.